All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on this, the 6th day of October, 2020. I do want to tell you that I am the author of a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. I publish every week, send out a weekly newsletter, usually on Saturday mornings, and then a monthly as well that summarizes what I consider the most important topics of that month. You go to miningstocks.com to sign up for my letter, miningstocks.com. Or you can call our office during the normal work hours at 718-457-1426, 718-457-1426. And also encourage you to consider subscribing to Chen Lin's letter, What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling? He's done an excellent job in the biotech space, as well as the energy and mining sectors as well. Chen has done extremely well for his investors, and you can go to chenpicks.com to sign up for his letter. And Michael Oliver is every other week is with us. Also, we like to plug Michael's work, olivermsa.com. I want to thank each of you for listening to the show, making it one of the more popular shows in the Voice America Business Channel. Also, want to thank you for sending along your questions and comments, positive, negative, whatever they may be. Send them along to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questions4taylor@gmail.com. And we do want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. Our sponsors for this week are Benchmark Metals, NV Gold, Hannon Metals, Irving Resources, Novo Resources, Sitka Gold Corp, Lion One Metals, Grand Portage, GMV Minerals, and SK Mining. I've titled today's show, COVID-19 and the Agendas to Come. That's after the title of a book of our guest today, James Perloff, and he will be with us during the second half of today's show. Never, at least in my 73 years of life in America, has there ever been a greater suppression of liberties than we have experienced this year with the rise of COVID-19. It is reminiscent, in my view, of the stories that we heard coming out of the Soviet Union when truth about starvation in the Ukraine was being suppressed by the New York Times, which, by the way, is once again suppressing an open discussion among scientists with respect to COVID-19 and what policies would be best for America. It is also reminiscent of the topic of global warming, where a free and open discussion among scientists of opposing views is not permitted. Or in the area of economics, where alternatives to Keynesian economics are not allowed to be heard and taught in our state-funded universities, even if it is clear that Keynesian economic policies absolutely have led to economic destruction over the longer run. In fact, as I will discuss in my upcoming Metals Investor Forum presentation on October 8th, Keynesian economics is leading us to the precipice of a depression as greater than that of the 1930s. So obviously there are some subjects that are not allowed to be discussed in America because they threaten a deeply entrenched elite and privileged class of people. And because many of their ideas have little or no merit, the only way to hold on to their privilege is to deny any debate. That is not the idea our founding fathers had. They gave us the First Amendment that protected us protected our rights to speak out, according to what we believe, and also gave us religious freedom. But as Ben Franklin said, we have given you a republic, now see if you can keep it. Of course, that so-called progressive president, Woodrow Wilson, didn't favor a republic. No, he was all in favor of a democracy over a republic, even though the word democracy never appeared in the Constitution. But that set the stage for the transfer Wilson did during his time, to set the transfer to from a republic to a democracy, which we are now seeing transformed into a mobocracy in the streets of Seattle, Portland, New York, and elsewhere. So a mobocracy, once you get rid of the republic and the forms of protection that our founding fathers built into our republic, like the Electoral College and various other things, then 51% of the majority can do whatever they want to 49% of the minority. And by what we've been seeing in the streets of Portland, Seattle, and elsewhere, that is would seem to be a distinct possibility for the future of our country. So the question is, why in America, where freedom of speech and religion had been such a revered value, have we allowed those rights to be taken away from us now? That question and several more related to it will be asked of James Perloff in the second half of today's show when we discuss his latest book, COVID-19, and the agendas to come. Meanwhile, in terms of turning hard times into good times, the opportunity is there for those who recognize the need to swap their savings out of dollar-denominated assets into assets that hold value, no matter how much money is printed by the Federal Reserve. In my presentation at 3:30 New York time this coming Thursday, October 8th, at the Metals Investor Forum, I will be explaining why this recession is different from any of the others that have occurred since the 1930s, and why a massive amount of fiscal stimulus funded by an equally massive amount of printing press money from the Fed is the only politically palatable policy for our government, no matter who wins the presidential election in November. So be sure to sign up for this event. You can do so by clicking the Metals Investor Forum banner at J Taylor Media. Attendance at this virtual event is free, but you do need to sign up for it beforehand. After my presentation, you will hear Dr. Quentin Henning of Novo Resources, Marcel Robillard of Puma Exploration, and Tom McNeil of Amanika Minerals and Metals talking about their projects. Novo, of course, is on to Dr. Henning and his team are on to building a mid-tier gold miner that will be starting to produce, expected to start producing in the first quarter of 2021. Puma Exploration is a company that has a project in New Brunswick, Canada, that is the spitting image of the emerging Galloway Metals project in southern BC that is on its way to becoming a multi-million high-grade near-surface gold deposit. And Amanika Mining and Metals is in the process of freeze mining some of the highest grade placer deposits ever reported in modern times at its BC project. Now, the only reason that has not been mined at this point in time is that because in the past, miners were not able to mine the gold from this underground environment that is very wet. But by freeze mining, much as is done in some of the uranium mines in Canada, the same technology can be used, has been used, has been demonstrated to be used, and used very safely and profitably with this very high-grade deposit. Amanika's main target, though, is the lode source of this placer material. It is a very exciting story, and all three of those are companies, of course, that I cover in my newsletter as well. So I'm happy to say that I have three very exciting companies, and they'll be telling their story after I do my presentation on October 8th, starting at 3:30 New York time. Also speaking at the conference before me will be Keith Schaefer and Eric Coffin, and following me will be Gwen Preston, and I'm sure you won't be sorry if you spend some time learning about some of the companies that will be presented at this forum. And speaking of spending your time wisely, I suggest one way to do that would be to stay with me during the commercial break that is coming up now, because when we come back, Ian Clausen, he's the president of Grand Portage, will be with me to talk about that company's very high-grade gold deposit that is taking shape with this summer's drill program in Alaska. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Ian Clausen.
The Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor. I'm really happy to have with me once again Ian Clausen. Ian adds 20 years of experience in business management, public relations, government affairs, entrepreneurialism to the companies that he manages in the junior exploration sector. And he has a very stellar academic background and also has served in government in Canada. And a really great guy. I've met him several times now on my trips to Vancouver, and I'm really pleased to have him with me today. He's here today. We did have him on once before to talk about GMV Minerals, another company that he's very much involved in leading. It's a company that I like. It's also a sponsor to this show. It's a company that I own. It's also a recommendation in my newsletter. But today we want to talk to him about Grand Portage, a sponsor of this show, and also one that I own and is in a recommendation in my newsletter. So I'm really pleased to have Ian with me. Before I say hello to Ian, I should tell you that the stock trades in Toronto under the symbol GPG. You can buy it in the U.S., as I have, under the symbol GPTRF. The last count that I have, 78.8 million shares outstanding, trading somewhere in the 49 to 50 cent Canadian range, the last I looked earlier today anyway. Giving it a market cap around $38 or $39 million in Canadian currency. Well, thanks for joining me, Ian.
Hi, Jay. Thanks very much. My pleasure to join you and your listeners. Listening to your opening, you mentioned 20 years. I guess nothing really stops the clock because it's closer to 30 years now. I've been in this business and I've known you for
maybe
about
that
10,
says our,
so nice to be here.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll make a note of that. But you have a very youthful picture, so I took the 20 years to be accurate, but that's probably just a dated bio, perhaps. We'll have to update it here when we have you on again. In any event, you have a very exciting story here, Grand Portage, the Herbert Project in Alaska. And, you know, you're starting out here with 606,000 ounces, grading just a little over 10 grams per ton, which is really quite stellar. Tell us about the project, the Grand Portage. Give our listeners an introduction to this story, which they haven't heard before.
You bet. We're thrilled to be working in Alaska. As you correctly point out, we have 606,500 indicated ounces in a 43-101 at just over 10 grams, but we also have 251,700 in the same 43-101 in the inferred category, and that's just over 14 grams.
Wow.
We were introduced to this property, which is in the historic Juneau Gold Belt of Southeast Alaska. We're sort of wedged almost halfway directly between the Kensington Mine, which is operated by Coeur, some of your listeners may know, and the historic Treadwell and AJ Mines to the south. Those are in and around the Juneau area, and in their day were two of the largest gold mines in the world. We started out with a 65-35% interest with Dr. Tom Patton and Katera, when you could have a pipeline of companies as a junior. This was the last one that they hung on to. And so we negotiated an earn-in where all the money went to the ground, went to the project. not to the company. And so we drilled it in 2010, 11, and 12, ended up in that period of time filing two 43-101 resource calculations. And in 2013, which really was our first one, we had about 182,000 ounces of gold at just shy of 7 grams, increased it back in 2017-18 when we re-drilled after going through a bit of a quiet period like a lot of juniors did. But we increased the asset both in terms of size and grade, just shy of 270,000 ounces at over 7.25 grams, and then an inferred calculation of just over 82,000 at over 6. In 2018, we drilled again and had a considerable success on what we're calling the Goat Vein, which was very rich in a number of intercepts, not only from surface, but as well as up to 200, 225 meters deep, so that we have the resource calculation that we do today.
Yeah, and but as I can see, looking at some of your materials on your website, you've really got a lot to shoot at yet. This is a vein system, and as I see, there seems to be quite a few of these veins. I don't know if they're all gold hosted or not, but they seem to be running more or less parallel to one another. How many veins have you tapped into? And you know, give us some idea of what the upside is in terms of targets yet to be explored and drilled into.
Sure. This is a mesothermal vein system, and they pinch and swell, but when they're quartz bearing, very often we're finding them, if not always, mineralized. The veins all lie in a east-west trajectory between two northwest-striking tectonic faults. So the system is easily identified. The veins themselves express at surface. Three of them express for up to about a kilometer at length at surface. And, of course, they're known to go very deep, 3,000 feet or more. So our geologists at this point feel that we're probably have only tested about 30% of the property. Our resource is only partially on three of the primary veins that we have drilled to date. And we've never really gone deep on this property. The budget just hasn't been there. We're still defining the tips on the resource from a lateral standpoint. But we certainly have identified approximately six of these veins that continue to look very good to us, continue to assay very well. And in 2018, we just expanded that prospectivity by doing what's called a LIDAR survey over our property holdings. And that unveiled, up to 16 new parallel structures to the south, which are all stacked just the same way, 2 to 225 meters apart, steeply dipping to the north. And, in fact, this summer we're putting our first drills into one of those veins and anxiously awaiting the assays back on that.
Mm-hmm. So they're about 200, did I hear you say, 200 meters or so apart, these veins?
That's right, yeah, about 2 to 225, depending upon where you're standing on the property.
And they come right up to surface, or how close to surface?
Yeah, no, they express right at surface. A little while ago, we did what's called a channel sample across some exposed quartz at the surface, and we ended up with just bonanza grade, 8.5 ounces over 1.12 meters, and not too far from that, about 3.5 ounces over a meter. Pretty spectacular right at surface.
So you would think that, I know it's too early to think about mining yet. You have a lot of drilling to do, and you're not miners, you're explorationists. But do you have any sense? Obviously, if it comes right up to surface, there would be some surface mining would be the idea, right?
Yeah, that's right. The main vein, the Goat Vein, the Deep Trench Vein, those are the three primary veins that we've spent a lot of time and effort on. They all express right at surface. We would likely start, this would be an underground mining operation. It's rich enough to be so. We would likely start on the Goat Vein, do about a 1,000-foot decline, Yeah, it would be stope mining, likely shrinkage method to start with, where we had a high measure of control. And then later, after more knowledge is developed, we would include some long-line stopes to be developed on the property as well.
From what you know at this stage, are all of these, the mineralization in these various veins, the same geological event? Is it the same system that, and as you mentioned, mesothermal deposits generally run deep? Is there some concept by your geologist that that this thing, that these veins could somewhere join at depth?
Yeah, you know, it's probably a little bit early to know. Until we go deep, we're not going to be able to figure that puzzle out. Although it's worth pointing out that you know, there's hundreds of rich gold splays that come off of these primary veins and lie between, and we know a number of them are mineralized. So when underground mining does occur, you know, those will be captured. This year, we had some really pleasant surprises out of drilling from the T pad going south, which is our northernmost pad. It was there to intercept this goat vein and the main vein, but we intercepted in both of the first two holes some really nice quartz that ended up with VG in it, and was in fact what we've just recently disclosed in our first assay results that came back. But yeah, it was nice to have, 2.7 meters of about 53 grams gold when we didn't expect to see it there. So, there could well be some areas to capture interest between the primary veins.
Interesting. Now, how much drilling have you done so far? How much has yet to be done, and how much have you reported and yet to be reported?
Yeah, this good summer. We're running two drill rigs. We'll have the one drill rig conclude on its final hole some point next week, and probably the week after that the other rig will conclude. So we're looking to do 22 holes for the entire work program that we're involved in right now. We've only received four holes back, and they've been disclosed. So we've got lots of assays to come back from the lab. It's been a pretty busy period for the labs, but also the COVID pandemic and staffing has certainly set them behind the eight ball. So things are slower than they have been before. But what we like about what we've seen so far this year is we stepped out, which we tend to do. This is all step out drilling as we're anxious to find the extent and the tips on the deposit, as I put it. But on these first holes, they came from platform T, our northernmost, as I mentioned, and pad U. And so what we've done is we've been able to demonstrate mineralized rock from the assay lab 170 meters to the east on the goat vein. That's further east, I should say, 170 meters than we've ever drilled before. Similarly, 100 meters extension on the deep trench vein. And in the main vein, the third, the center of our deposit, we've gone 200 meters deeper than ever before, and all three of these have ended up returning mineralized gold in the veins. So, you know, this is a quick way to add tons and ounces to a deposit, and we really like what we're seeing even after just four holes.
Well, you're liking in terms of continuity, I guess, at this stage anyway?
Absolutely, yeah.
Continuity of mineralization.
Very reliable and predictable, yep.
Any metallurgical studies done yet on this material? It sounds like it's mostly quartz, and it doesn't sound like it's something that'd be problematic generally, but have you done any work on that yet?
Yeah, we've done a number of bottle roll tests on the three primary veins to test with cyanide to see if there's any refractory mineralization. There's none. Gravity tests, which is your cheapest recovery, we're getting, you know, mid-90s recoveries in gold, high 70s in silver. So, we're really pleased with what we're seeing on the metallurgical side.
And some of the other issues that we always have to check off the boxes on, infrastructure, native issues.
Infrastructural standpoint, we're located 6 minutes by air from the Juneau Airport. We're close to tidewater, power, skilled workforce, familiar with mining. So from a geographic standpoint, we're really quite lucky to have something as close to urban Alaska as you can pretty much get. No native issues to speak of, not like our fellows, compatriots, if you will, exploring the province of British Columbia, where it's often an issue to resolve. But no, we have no issues on that regard in Southeast Alaska.
All I can say is you've got a very low market cap compared to a lot of companies these days that have done well with their exploration. It seems like this is an opportunity for people, given the fact that you're not overpriced yet. I would say with lots of upside. How's your funding situation at this stage? I guess you have enough to take you through this drill season, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we are a junior. We're competing with all the other juniors out there. The difference between our portfolio and perhaps some others is, we come to the table with 860,000 ounces already in a 43-101 and just looking to grow that this year. From a funding standpoint, we raised a couple of million dollars early in 2020, and then Eric Sprott, who probably easily one of the most renowned commodity gold investors in the world, asked us to consider a $3 million placement, which we very happily did in the end of June. He's our single largest individual shareholder now. He is the reason we were able to put a second drill to work on the property this summer. So we will end the season with somewhere in the vicinity of $2.2, $2.3 million in the treasury, which is pretty enviable, knowing that next year we can come out of the gate and funding requirements are not going to be ever present like they have been historically.
Yeah, well, it's a good feeling, a great feeling, and it's a great time for our sector, Ian, because companies are able to raise money and they're putting geological theories to the test, and when they're successful, it's just a lot of fun. That's for sure, and it looks like we should have a lot of fun keeping our eyes on what's coming. You'll have a lot of information, a lot of drill results coming in the next, several weeks, I suppose.
Yeah, the way the labs are running, Jay, we're probably looking at news flow right into the early new year, given the fact we still have both rigs turning right now.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess you'll set up a new exploration program early next year, probably, based on the results this year.
Exactly. Yeah, we'll digest the results when we get them all in and formulate our plan for 2021, apply for permits, and if we connect enough dots, we'll likely commission an update to our 43-101 so that we keep interested stakeholders and shareholders apprised of our growth.
Getting over the million ounces there, possibly, I would think. Hopefully.
Well, exactly. That's this year's mandate.
Okay. Well, it looks like you're on the right track. All right. Well, I want to thank you very much. Any last word, or have we covered pretty much what we need to from an introductory point of view today?
No. In a few minutes, I think we were pretty thorough. I would just, if you like gold in the United States in a safe jurisdiction with lots of upside from a drilling standpoint, please keep an eye on us. I think we've got what it takes to surprise a few people.
Yeah, and your website, of course. What is it? I should have had it jotted down here.
Yeah, grandportage.com.
Okay.
And if anyone's interested in signing up for future news release dissemination or keep an eye on us that way, we'd be happy to take your details and put you on our list.
Certainly a recommendation for me to do that, and also a recommendation that you follow them through my newsletter, because it's one of my favorites. So thank you so much, Ian, for being with us today, and we'll look to keep up with your story going forward.
Thank you, Jay. Stay safe. Best to your listeners.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. All right, folks. Well, we do have to go to break, but don't go away, because I'll be right back with James Perloff, author of COVID-19 and the Agenda to Come. Should be a very interesting topic, very interesting comments from James, so don't go away. We'll be right back.
Voice America is available on your Google connected device.
Okay, Google, play Turning Hard Times into Good Times podcast on iHeartRadio.
Try it today.
And
NV Gold Corp, trading under NVX on the TSX and NVGLF on the OTC, is a gold exploration company focused on uncovering the next multi-million ounce gold deposit in North America. With an aggressive exploration season ahead in 2020, a tight share structure, strong management ownership, key strategic investors including Eric Sprott, a globally recognized technical team, technical coverage from industry gold experts, and cash in its treasury. Visit nvgoldcorp.com to learn more on this exciting story.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again James Perloff. He was with us a couple of years back. I think 2017 might have been the last time we had him on the show. James is the author of a number of books. The first one that I think the first one that he wrote was The Shadows of Power, an expose of private influence on American foreign policy that is it's sold over, well, at least the last count, over 100,000 copies. He's written a bunch of other books as well. I really have a very high regard for James and his intellect and his honesty and his willingness to take on issues that are, you know, not the kind of issues that the mainstream media necessarily wants you to think about or talk about. But he has the courage to go and to say what he believes is true. And that is really what I think is very important in a day in which people are really trying to be politically correct and ignore, in many cases, ignore the truth about various issues. The book that we want to talk to him today is COVID-19 and the Agendas to Come, Red Pilled. In this book, he asks some really hard questions about the global response to COVID-19, and that is mostly what I want to talk to him today about. James, thanks for joining me again.
Well, Jay, thank you. It's like you said, it's been a few years, but really good to be back on the air with you.
It is good to have you back, and I should mention it's jamesperloff.com, folks, if you want to follow up after our discussion today with all that James is doing, jamesperloff, P-E-R-L-O-F-F.com. James, you know, as I mentioned, the first time I learned about you was through a book called The Shadows of Power. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that book, just an overview of what it's about?
Sure. I became what you might call blue-pilled, and that is a metaphor that's taken from the film The Matrix. People who are blue-pilled basically just accept whatever the world media tells them, and people who are red-pilled have started to wake up to what's really going on. I got red-pilled, you might say, when I read Gary Allen's book, Then They Call It a Conspiracy, in 1978. Then I began writing for the New American Magazine in the mid-1980s. And they asked me to write an article in 1988, which turned out to be a book, The Shadows of Power. It's a study of the Council on Foreign Relations. And what this deals with is the reality that America is not really a democracy, but rather we're run by a financial oligarchy that runs behind the scenes under the facade of democracy. And they were using the Council on Foreign Relations as a means to supply cabinet-level personnel to presidents, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. And that's easily documentable. I mean, I mean, they've had about 20 each of secretaries of state, secretaries of treasury, secretaries of war and defense, and CIA directors. If you go through the records, they've just dominated. And but that was, you know, the old American establishment, the Rockefeller Morgan means of controlling our domestic and foreign policies. And so that was a bestseller in 1988, and I've continued to explore geopolitics since then, always following a learning curve of my own.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Donald Trump is a problem for these folks?
Well, he certainly has the right sound bites. You know, I voted for the guy, and you know, it really in 2016 it was absolute no brainer to vote for him against Hillary, because Hillary Clinton, not only did she get more donations from Goldman Sachs and Wall Street than anybody else, but every plank in her agenda, in her platform, was what you might call Rothschild. It was, you know, control of the internet. She was a hawk on wars. She was pro, you know, the gay, transgender agenda. When you name it, she was bad news. Donald had a lot of the right sound bites. I've been concerned with some of the subservience he's shown to Netanyahu and the Zionist lobby here in America. When it comes to I don't know if I should say the word or not, I'll call it the big C, the disease we're dealing with right now. He's given some mixed signals. He advocated hydroxychloroquine, which was a really good thing, and which the big pharma has been trying to suppress. On the other hand, he established Operation Warp Speed in the White House to get a COVID vaccine out, which we really don't need. We can get the reasons for that. But, I mean, even according to the CDC, as of May the 22nd of this year, 99.74% of all Americans were surviving COVID without a vaccine, and they were using inflated death counts even in that case. Okay. So I'm not I'm very guarded about Trump. Let me put it that way. I do certainly support Trump's supporters, the deplorables, the constitutionalists, the people who are patriots. I'm 100% behind them. I think that Trump himself may be compromised if we were to look deep into some of the policies that he's implemented and some of the people that are surrounding him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned that you have been following geopolitics since you wrote The Shadows of Power. Mm-hmm. Do you see some connections? Perhaps you can help us. If there are some connections between your latest book, COVID-19, and The Shadows of Power, because your Shadows of Power really look forward to a lot of things that have come to pass, I think, since that book was written. I believe that was back, when did you write that book?
It was published in 88, although 88, it was right. Actually kind of in the works for a couple of years before that it was published.
Okay, so can you see some connections?
Oh, absolutely. You know, in that book, I spoke about how the Council on Foreign Relations had consistently advocated world government. And I documented that from articles in their journal, Foreign Affairs, going back to 1922, when they were advocating joining the League of Nations and saying that only world government would solve the world's problems. David Rockefeller, who was chairman of the council for many years, of course, was a big advocate of world government. And now we see in the wake of COVID that Gordon Brown, the former UK prime minister, is advocating global government to solve the COVID crisis. We definitely see continuity here. And what's most frightening to me, Jay, is this channeling of all these COVID things into a global reset, cashless society, a global vaccine, probably mandatory, and a global digital ID. It seems that Bill Gates is at the helm of a lot of this stuff, even though he has no medical credentials. So definitely the things I spoke about and the things we've warned about in alt media about a new world order coming and a globalization of the world in a very negative way are coming to fruition. And I'm especially concerned about this global reset that the World Economic Forum is predicting will come in 2021.
2021, you're predicting what?
The World Economic Forum is calling for a global reset. And they've put out a video where people like the head of the World Bank and Prince Philip keep talking about COVID as an opportunity, they say, despite the tens of millions of people who are out of work and suffering. They say it's an opportunity to change the world, and I'm afraid they're going to come up with a cashless society, you know, a digital ID, and we might follow the prototype of communist China, which ever since Henry Kissinger dragged Richard Nixon over there in 1972, they've been building up with American investment a technocratic society there. They don't even use cash anymore in China. They're communist, which, you know, the communists usually lag behind the West, but we've given them Western technology, and they're utilizing that with facial recognition, cashlessness, and police state, high-tech police state, which I'm afraid may indeed be a prototype for what is planned for us here in the West.
So they have a social grading, I think, as well. So if you're not thinking the right thing or talking about the right thing or having the right religion or saying the right thing about the political system or whatever, in other words, your freedoms, your liberties, the kind of things that we've taken for granted in America over the decades, basically the government would have a way to shut you down, essentially, to deny you, to deny you your revenues, to deny you to get on an airplane, those kind of issues, right?
Yeah, even before COVID, they were had social credit scores in China, which meant that if you were obedient to the government, you had a better opportunity to travel, a better opportunity for a good job, a better opportunity to go shopping. And so this is very systematic installation of the totalitarian state on a technological level.
Okay, looking at some of the chapters in your book, I think we've touched on the second chapter, Destruction of Civil Liberties, just now, and what the remarks you just made. But chapter three, was the lockdown necessary? What are some of the thoughts that you express in your book about that?
Well, I talk about the lockdown's damage to our health, you know, the delayed cancer and heart screenings, the fact that Reuters says 28 million Americans are now at risk of being homeless because they can't pay rent or mortgage. Mm-hmm. How can being homeless be good for your health? You know, there was a survey before COVID that showed that 49% of Americans were living paycheck to paycheck. And we know that without people working, there's limited tax revenues for the government, and the government cannot continue to sustain this lockdown indefinitely. We're looking at a potential financial collapse. I'm sure you, I think you would agree with that. And
yeah,
that could be
absolutely
one of the things that would lead to the reset. But as far as why the lockdown is unnecessary, I have a chapter that is chock full of scientists from around the world, not just from America, from around the world, who say from a medical perspective, there's no justification for the lockdown. You know, I quote, for example, Drs. Erickson and Masihi, who had a YouTube video out. They tested more people out in the they're out in Bakersfield, California. They tested more people than anybody else in their region for COVID. And they said that the chances of dying from COVID in California are 0.03%. In other words, it's something similar to a flu. And they said, absolutely, we should not lock down. Well, that was censored by YouTube. Mm-hmm. And I quote many other people in this. But one thing I wanted to do with this book, Jay, is many of the people like them and Dr. Knut Witkowski, the epidemiologist, and Dolores Cahill, the eminent PhD immunologist from University College Dublin, they've all been censored by YouTube. I went through and I either found transcripts of their interviews or made transcripts myself, and then I took key excerpts because I wanted this to be preserved in hard copy, because I've got a website, but I now know when the digital information, that can go out the door anytime. So I wanted to really preserve this. But I quote in that chapter, you were referring to Sukrat Bhakti, various German virologists who all say that absolutely there's no justification for lockdown. The death rates are so low that there's no comparison to the death that will come from the lockdowns and the economic destruction and the tens of thousands, or if not hundreds of thousands, of small businesses that are going bankrupt.
Well, in your book, you do say that you're not taking this disease lightly, that it is serious. And you have a medical background yourself. I think you were a nurse, a registered nurse in the past. But could you put this in perspective, though? I think in one of your chapters you talk about how this compares with other means of dying. I mean, there's lots of ways that people die. So putting this in perspective, how does this compare with some of the other much larger methods of dying?
Right. Well, it was interesting when President Trump announced the lockdown nationally, which is Friday the 13th in March. At that time, and this is from the Worldometer's website, they said there were 21,000 deaths from coronavirus, but seasonal flu counted for 113,000, malaria 228,000, suicides 249,000, traffic accidents 313,000, HIV 390,000, alcohol deaths 581,000, smoking over a million, cancer almost 2 million. It just goes on up. I'm not completing the list there. And also, if you put in perspective, we've seen worse pandemics than this in my lifetime. And when I was a child, at the age of 6 in 1957, I got a shot for the Asian flu. Well, the Asian flu killed more than a million worldwide. That's more than COVID, even if you accept the inflated COVID numbers. We can get into how they've inflated the numbers. But the Asian flu, you've got to remember that the world population back then was 2.8 million compared to 7.5 million today. So it's about one-third. So over a million deaths then was like more than 3 million today, yet nobody dreamed of locking down economies or masking or social distancing. We're seeing something that never happened before, and I am a registered nurse, still am. I retired last year. I was a registered nurse for 45 years. And in the history of America, we have never quarantined healthy people. This is entirely contrary to protocols. And I have to say, Jay, that as a geopolitical writer, I started writing for the New American in 1985, 35 years ago. I've never seen greater disparity in the mass media and government spokesmen, a greater disparity between what they're saying and what reality and logic say. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with a crazy pandemic. The death rates are plunging. And Ron Paul has spoken about this in July. In one of his Liberty reports, he said the death rates are down 90%. So why isn't the media celebrating this good news that the mm-hmm. death rates from COVID are plunging? Instead, they started talking about the case numbers, which is based not on people being sick, not on people dying. It's based on the PCR test. And as one eminent German lawyer put it recently, what we're dealing with now is a PCR pandemic. You know, people test positive, but these people are not, for the most part, symptomatic. We're actually, and I quote a number of epidemiologists in my book from Italy, from England, from Switzerland. I quote Beta Stadler, who's the former head of the Institute of Immunology in Switzerland, says the disease is gone at this point. What they're detecting in the PCR test is just fragments of DNA that people have encountered from, when their immune system ran into COVID, but they didn't get sick from it. And this is craziness too. Yet what you're seeing is the death rates go down in places like Australia, New Zealand, and England, and in some places, America, the COVID lockdown measures are clamping down. Thank God for Pennsylvania and Michigan, where courts have now ruled that their lockdowns are unconstitutional.
Yeah. We can only hope, because I guess the idea is that if you keep enough people dependent, I mean, you said even before the pandemic, lots of people, a large percentage of Americans were living paycheck to paycheck. Mm-hmm. So if you take their jobs away, then they have nobody to turn to but the government, essentially.
Right.
So now you've got some locked in votes, don't you?
Well, you've got to certainly have a prescription for socialism there. Unfortunately, I have heard reports that people are getting very comfortable living at home and yeah. getting the government paychecks. But obviously, as you and I know, the government can't keep paying these paychecks forever. It would have to expand the money supply. That would inflate the currency and collapse it ultimately. And I think that's what the World Economic Forum is probably salivating for as they look forward to what they're calling the Great Economic Reset of 2021.
Yeah, it would seem to be in the cards. And certainly some of the people that I follow, people like, there's a various, you know, high-profile people
that are
certainly talking about this. Well, I'm talking about the from Yale. I'm missing his name right now. The economist at Yale who was at Morgan Stanley for many years, mm-hmm. Now talking about how he thinks the dollar is on its last legs. Certainly a lot of people on this show that we talk to believe that mm-hmm. that's the case. So it would be coming together. And the COVID-19, the lockdown, would accelerate the process and make sure it happens, I would think. But certainly the only thing the policymakers can do now, James, is to – the only thing they know to do that's politically palatable, at least, is to print more money and accelerate this right. process of – of indebtedness and eventually a currency that becomes worthless, I guess, which is why, of course, I'm telling our listeners that they should be buying gold and transferring their mm-hmm. Their dollars while they still have some value into tangible assets. But let's get into it with just a few minutes we have left here. Theories about the nature of COVID-19 and how it was spread. You have a chapter, you have maybe a few chapters in your book talking about that. What are some of the theories about where it came from, how it was, you know, what are some of the ideas that both the mainstream and people outside the mainstream are expressing?
Yeah, well, this book is it's broken into 27 very short chapters and five sections. The first section is on the lockdown, which is, it's undisputable we've had a lockdown. I wanted to stick with that at the beginning because it's indisputable. Then they talk about how they've panicked the public through hyperinflation of numbers, and there's various ways they've done that, such as conflating COVID with other diseases, tampering with death certificates, et cetera. But as far as theories go, that's the third section of the book. Mm-hmm. And I start with a chapter on the mainstream theory of the origin, which is that it was this wet food market in Wuhan mm-hmm. that was selling bat soup. But some people say they never did sell bats or bat soup. Then I go into the bioweapon theory, that this was bioengineered. And I quote a number of very credible sources, Dr. Shiva Ayyadari, from MIT, who, he has 4 degrees from MIT, who is pointing out that this had to be engineered in a lab. I quote Dr. Francis Boyle, who drafted the U.S. language for the Biochemical Weapons Convention. He quotes a number of scientific studies. I quote a paper from 9 Indian scientists saying that based on the examination of the genome of the virus, it could only come about in the lab. I quote Luc Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the HIV virus. He says this mm-hmm. could not possibly have come about by any place but a lab, as well as Meryl Nass, biochemical weapons expert, and others, on the fact that this is clearly coming. If we consider this a virus, it's clearly coming from an engineering process. But I also look at other theories in the book. I look at the 5G theory. There, I quote people on both sides of the argument. There's responsible people from both sides, but there are people, for example, Dr. Ronald Kostoff of the Georgia Institute of Technology believes that 5G, remember that Wuhan was the rollout city for 5G in China, mm-hmm. that 5G is weakening people's immune system and make them more vulnerable to it. And Meg DeHavis, PhD, points out, she's done studies that show there's a much higher correlation of coronavirus, the COVID, in areas that do have 5G as opposed to don't. Not to say that it doesn't occur in people in regions that don't have 5G. But there's some other theories. I quote Dr. Stephanie Seneff of MIT, who believes that airborne glyphosate is a factor. Dr. Zach Bush, who thinks that the air pollution in northern Italy, in Wuhan, New York City, was a factor. I quote Dr. Andrew Kaufman, who says that under an electron microscope, the coronavirus looks exactly like something called exosomes, which are exudates from cells that are expelling wastes. And he says these wastes could come from another source. So I try to quote a number of sources, not taking aside myself, but I try to leave as many options open. But certainly in doing so, I step outside the realm of consideration of the mainstream media, which simply says, always says, it's simply a natural mutation of the coronavirus.
Right. That's what they say. And I should tell my listeners, it's jamesperloff.com. And James, all of your books are thoroughly, very, very thoroughly documented. I must say you obviously do a lot of work. A lot of work goes into these books and a lot of checking your sources before you put them in there. So it's very, very important that people know that. I think we should end on perhaps your comments in chapter 27, hope and encouragement, because as you point out, if you read everything up until that point in time, it can get pretty depressing. In fact, a lot of people are depressed these days by what's going on. But sure. you offer some encouragement, noting that at least from a Christian point of view, there is no reason that we should lose hope.
Right. Well, what I point out is, you know, if you look at the biometric IDs that they're planning to actually, this is from it's not a conspiracy theory. It's from Rice School of Bioengineering. I quote them on how they're at the request of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, they're actually planning to inject people with a digital tattoo that'll have your vaccination record. And now they've got a project in West Africa where with MasterCard, they're integrating your financial data with your vaccination data. You can't get much closer to the mark of the beast than this when you consider that right now in many stores in America you can't buy or sell without a mask. Well, mm-hmm. we're only one step away from telling people they can't buy or sell unless you've got a vaccination tattoo mm-hmm. on you. But in terms of hope and encouragement, I point out to people the Bible doesn't end with the Antichrist, it ends with Christ. And in that chapter, I quote many, many people, the former tennis champion Murat Safin, who's awake to what's going on. I quote members of parliament from foreign countries. I quote doctors from around the world. I quote mainstream media journalists from Sky News and Fox who are speaking up about this. I quote religious leaders from the Orthodox Church, the Catholic Church, the Evangelical Church, and Muslims as well, who are awake to the fact that something is coming down that has nothing to do with our health. I mean, when you've got a survival rate of 99.74% from the CDC as of May, and it's even lower according to the CDC now, they say if you're between 20 and 49, according to the CDC, your chances of surviving COVID are 99.996%. But I want to stress something. This is where I put a disclaimer in. I know we're almost out of time. That Bill Gates keeps hinting at pandemic two, and that there's something going to happen in the fall that will get people's attention. I am concerned that actual death rates will start to climb in the fall. Either there was a new bioweapon or they turn on 5G at full force. We know that at 60 gigahertz, it has a very negative effect on oxygen absorption. So there's a lot of things that could happen, but people have to get the book. Again, it's called COVID-19, The Agendas to Come, a Red Pilled, ranked number one on Amazon yesterday for respiratory Excellent. Disease category.
Wonderful. So congratulations. Yeah. James, we have to go. We'll have to leave it go at that. But thank you so much. Very entertaining, very important information, and very well documented. Thank you so much. That is it for this week, folks. Next week, I'm going to have Rick Rule with me. Dr. Quentin Henning is going to be talking about XK mining, and Michael Oliver is with us. And so until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.